Gracie, I wish you hadn't arranged
For us to have lunch with Jack.
It's always so embarrassing.
What do you mean?
One of those lousy tips he leaves.
He's been eating here 5 years, and he's yet to tip more than a dollar.
Well, a dollar isn't a bad tip.
That's for the 5 years.
Besides, if we're his guests, he'll make us order crackers and milk. The cheapest thing on the menu.
Well, George, I wish you wouldn't talk that way about Jack. He's always been awfully nice to me. Did you see the birthday present he sent me?
Why, no.
Well, it's a coupon which entitles me to a year's subscription to Hoffert Bazaar.
From Jack?
Mm-hmm. And all I have to do is fill it out and send it in with $7.
Hoffert Bazaar is $6.
Well, Jack gets a dollar commission.
Hi, this is Milton Berle. George Burns is a priceless treasure. I say is because George Burns is an icon who will live forever. But more important to me was the friendship that we shared for so many years. I'd say 80 years we knew each other. We grew up together in show business, going way back to when we were starting out in vaudeville. In the smallest cities and towns, you couldn't believe it. All over the United States. Dumps. Small theaters. Oh, the worst. His real name was Nat Birnbaum, but he never used it. His act was so bad, he had to change his name from city to city so that the theater managers wouldn't know who he was and hire him. But he developed his act, and he always said to me that he was very grateful for the opportunity to be bad so that he could learn to become good. We ran across each other on the way up, and we finally reached the top of the world of vaudeville. Yes, I remember very well. The Palace Theater in New York. We'd hang out together at Lindy's Restaurant on Broadway, both of us smoking cigars, swapping lies, telling each other stories of our education and our experiences on the road. And boy, I want to say something, that George was a great storyteller, as you're going to hear. Well, George became Burns of Burns and Allen, and I became Uncle Milty. We became part of the history of show business of this century. Radio, movies, television. We were together at the beginning of it all. We were very good friends, really good friends. Our families were close and our children grew up together, and it's a relationship that I've always cherished. He was 12 years older than I. You know, when George was 96, I was 84. And I'll never forget this story that really happened. At a party one night, he said to me, in his voice and his style, he said, "Hey, Burl, how old are you?" I said, 84. George said, 84? Give me a glass of water, kid. Yes, George was a rare, talented, funny human being, and he squeezed a lot of living in his short 100 years. You know, it would be very hard to count the friends that he made in his time. He was loved by all of them, everyone. He had so many funny stories and anecdotes about everybody. All I can say is, enjoy the words of my dear friend, George Burns.
Excerpts from 100 Years, 100 Stories by George Burns, read by John Biner. To most people, a vacation is taking off from work and going someplace. That has never excited me. I don't mind going someplace, but I want to have a date to play when I get there. So I'm still trying to figure out how I got talked into it. But on our fourth anniversary, I found myself off work for 3 weeks and headed for Russia via Paris and Budapest. There were three of us making the trip, myself, Gracie, and Jack Pearl's wife, Winnie, whom Gracie had invited to come along. We crossed first class on the Île-de-France, and when we arrived in Paris, we checked into the George Sank Hotel, pretty classy for a guy with nothing booked. On our first night in Paris, we decided to go to a Russian restaurant. You see, there's an old show business tradition. If you do a new show, you break it in New Haven before you bring it to New York. So we thought we'd better do the same thing with our stomachs. We'd break in the Russian food in Paris, and if we liked it, we'd take our stomachs to Russia. It was a beautiful Russian restaurant, but when we sat down, I noticed the dinners cost $15 apiece, and believe me, in 1930 that was a fortune. So I said, "Girls, our dinner's going to be $45 without any tip. This place is too expensive for us." The girls agreed and started to order. That's when the waiter asked, "Would you like to begin your dinner with a little caviar?" I said, "Certainly we want a little caviar." And after he left, I turned to the girls. "What a question. Do we want to begin our dinner with a little caviar? For $15, I want not only caviar, I want a suit with 2 pair of pants to go with it." I must admit the food was excellent, so we decided to take our stomachs with us to Russia, until the bill came. They had charged us an extra $4 apiece for the caviar. That meant that dinner had amounted to $19 each, and I'm not going to tell you how much it came to with the tip, or I'll start to cry again. From there, like all good tourists, we went to the Folies Bergère to see the world-famous nudes. In the middle of the show, with 40 beautiful nude girls on stage, Gracie leaned over to me and whispered, "George, it's a little shocking, isn't it?" I whispered back, "Shocking? It's outrageous. I'll never eat there again." Fanny Brice was one of Broadway's biggest stars ever. She wasn't beautiful, but when she sang "My Man" in the Ziegfeld Follies, she stopped the show. Later, on radio, she was a smash for years with her Baby Snooks character. A few years before Fanny died, I visited her in the hospital. She was very weak, confused, and forgetful. When I greeted her, she didn't even recognize me. "Fanny," I said, "it's me, George Burns." "I don't know any George Burns," she mumbled. "We've been friends for 40 years. Never saw you." "Don't you remember," I said, "we were on the same bill at the Schubert Theater in Chicago?" "I never played Chicago." "Of course you did. You were a sensation," I reminded her. "They were paying you $5,000 a week." "It was $6,500," she whispered. That she remembered. My father was a gentle, contented, religious scholar and a great provider. He provided my mother with 12 kids. That was it. How she managed to feed us all on what he'd bring in, correction, didn't bring in, will always be a mystery to me. Whenever he wasn't at the synagogue studying the Talmud, he'd be at some other small synagogue singing the services as a part-time cantor. That didn't happen very often because his singing voice sounded a lot like mine. I remember one year he was asked to sing at a synagogue on Clinton Street for the high holidays. This was a very poor little synagogue, so my father agreed to do it for nothing. That year, on the night when the period of fasting was over, all of us were gathered in the kitchen, waiting for dinner. My father was laughing and joking and teasing us kids. He seemed unusually elated. My mother didn't exactly share his mood, because she was busy trying to water down a stew to the point where it would feed a bunch of kids who hadn't eaten in 24 hours. She looked at my father and said, "What are you so happy about? That synagogue is paying you nothing." My father turned to her and with a big, broad smile said, "I know, but they asked me to come back again next year." Let's face it, my father wasn't handled by the William Morris Agency. Unlike my father, my mother was a very practical lady. Nothing ever flustered her. No matter what the problem was, somehow she knew how to handle it. A perfect example happened when I was 7 years old. I was singing with 3 other Jewish kids from the neighborhood. We called ourselves the Pee Wee Quartet. Now, there was a big department store, Siegel and Cooper, that threw an annual picnic, and the highlight was an amateur contest with talent representing all the churches in New York. Right around the corner from where we lived was a little Presbyterian church. How it got in that neighborhood, I'll never know. It certainly didn't do a big business. Well, they had no one to enter in the contest, so the minister asked us 4 kids to represent the church. We jumped at the chance. So that Sunday, there we were, the Pee Wee Quartet, 4 Jewish boys sponsored by a Presbyterian church, and our opening song was "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling." We followed that with "Mother McCree," and won the first prize. The church got a purple velvet altar cloth, and each of us kids got an Ingersoll watch, which was worth about 85 cents. Well, I was so excited I ran all the way home to tell my mother. When I got there, she was on the roof, hanging out the wash. I rushed up to her and said, "Mama, I don't want to be a Jew anymore." If this shocked her, she certainly didn't show it. She just looked at me and calmly said, "Do you mind me asking why?" I said, "Well, I've been a Jew for 7 years and never got anything. I was a Presbyterian for one day, and I got a watch." And I held out my wrist to show it to her. She glanced at it and said, "First, help me hang up the wash. Then you can be a Presbyterian." While I was hanging up the wash, some water ran down my arm and got inside the watch. It stopped running, so I became a Jew again. One summer when I was 7 years old, before I started singing with the Pee Wee Quartet, I hit upon the idea of going into the ice business. When it's hot, everybody needs ice. I made myself a pull cart out of an apple crate and two old baby buggy wheels. I nailed a stick onto the front to pull it, and I'd haul my cart down to an ice house by the East River and buy a 100-pound cake of ice for 5 cents. Then I'd pull it back to my neighborhood, split the cake into 4 quarters, and sell each one for 5 cents. I was making a 15-cent profit on every cake of ice. By hustling, I would be able to do this 3 times a day, which meant I could make a profit of $2.25 in a 5-day week. Unfortunately, I never made it to the end of the first week. In order to get to the ice house, I had to go right through the middle of this Italian neighborhood. And on the 4th day, I was happily running along with my second cake of ice when these two rough-looking kids stopped me. Right away, I knew I was in trouble when one of them said, "Hey, kid, I never saw you in this neighborhood. What's your name?" I knew I had to come up with an Italian name, so I blurted out the only one I could think of. "Enrico Caruso." The bigger of the two stuck his face right in front of mine and snarled, "Are you Catholic?" I looked right back at him and said, "Are you kidding? My father's a priest." That was the end of my ice business. They took my cart and my ice and chased me all the way back to Rivington Street. There were two fellows on the Lower East Side of New York, Maxie Rheingold and Sidney Solomon. They went into vaudeville and called themselves Ryan and Sullivan, singers, dancers, and roller skaters. When they split up, I dropped Burns, became Sullivan, and went to work with Ryan. Then Sullivan got a new partner, and we did the same acts. So now you had Ryan and Sullivan and Ryan. We split up again, and we all got new partners. So now you had Ryan and Sullivan, Sullivan and Ryan, Ryan and Ryan, Sullivan and Sullivan. Then we split up again. Now you had Ryan and Sullivan, Sullivan and Ryan, Ryan and Ryan, Sullivan and Sullivan, the Ryan boys, and the Sullivan brothers. Before we were through, everybody on the east side was named either Ryan or Sullivan. There was one kid living there named Jaime Goldberg. He moved. He told me he was afraid to live in an Irish neighborhood. In my vaudeville days, I was surprised to see how many performers hit the bottle, and when they overdid it, they didn't always know the condition they were in. I was on the Pantages circuit one time with the monologist Jack Whitehead and a dancing team called the Gliding Gascoines. Gascoigne and Whitehead did a lot of drinking together. One night they got really bombed, and Gascoigne passed out in his dressing room. Whitehead sent for a doctor, who showed up immediately. And when Whitehead came out of the dressing room, I said, "How's Gascoigne?" "Terrible," Whitehead replied. The doctor asked him if he was seeing any pink elephants or green snakes, and Gascoigne said no, and the room was full of them. When I was in my early 20s, I played Philadelphia a lot. Every time I played Philadelphia, I always stopped in a little hotel called the Hurley House. I'll never forget the Hurley House. All us small-time vaudeville actors stopped there. And there was a reason. Her name was Trixie Hicks, a very sexy waitress. Whenever you'd order breakfast, which consisted of a donut and coffee, Trixie would bring it up to your room. And she always stayed. She loved coffee. I'm trying to keep it clean. Well, one morning I ordered breakfast, and when she brought it up, I said, "Trixie, how about a little coffee?" And she said, "I'd love to." Naturally, I locked the door. I didn't want the coffee to get cold. 10 minutes later, there was a knock on the door. And that was kind of bad, because I was right in the middle of my second cup. Let me tell you something. When I was in my 20s, I was good for 3 or 4 cups a night. And in the morning, I'd have a little demitasse. Anyway, the guy knocking on the door turned out to be Hurley, the man who owned the hotel. He hollered, "Is Trixie Hicks in there?" I got kind of panicky. I had an adjoining room with an actor named Jack Milo. So I knocked on Milo's door. Milo opened his door and I threw Trixie in. I let Hurley in. He looked around and couldn't find Trixie, so he left. Then I knocked on Milo's door, but he wouldn't give back Trixie. So I phoned downstairs to Hurley and I said, "If you're looking for Trixie Hicks, she's in Jack Milo's room." Hurley came up, knocked on Milo's door. Milo opened my door and threw Trixie back. But this story has a sad ending. In the meantime, my coffee got cold. I love that story. There have been many times I wished I could enjoy coffee as much as I did when I was 21. To me, the funniest comedian ever was Charlie Chaplin. The biggest talent was Sammy Davis Jr., and the greatest entertainer of all time was Al Jolson. And that distinctive singing style of his, Jolson found that by accident, the night of one of his shows. He went to Lindy's restaurant in New York for dinner and had a double order of vegetables and sour cream. That happens to be a dish that consists of radishes, cucumbers, and onions. An hour later, while he was on stage singing April Showers, he got a stomachache. He sang, "Though April showers, oh, may come your way, oh," and the audience loved it. And that was just from the radishes and cucumbers. When the onions hit him, he fell down on one knee, stayed there, finished the song, and turned out to be a sensation. In vaudeville, you had to get off to a good start. So I always knocked my brains out trying to come up with a great opening. The first time Gracie and I worked together, this is what I came up with. I walked out on stage alone, stepped to the edge, leaned over to the orchestra leader in the pit, and said to him, "You see this little book? It tells 20 foolproof ways to meet girls." He said, "Give me one way to meet a girl." I said, "Okay, you take an impossible name like Mamie Dittenfest. Then you go up to a girl and say, 'Pardon me, aren't you Mamie Dittenfest?' She'll say no. You say, 'Well, you certainly look like her.' The next thing you know, you're buying her a cup of coffee." At that point, Gracie made her entrance. I said to the orchestra leader, "Watch this." Then I said to Gracie, "I beg your pardon, is your name Mamie Dittenfest?" And she said, "Yes." It's what's known as a shock laugh. I was shocked that it didn't get one. That Dettenfest opening I just told you about lasted for one performance. In fact, that entire act lasted for one performance. In show business, you have to learn from your mistakes. Fortunately for Gracie and me, that was one time I learned fast. The way I had it, Gracie was the straight man. Pardon me, the straight person. I was the comedian with the funny hat and the big bow tie that lit up and twirled around. I noticed that the audience laughed at Gracie's straight questions, and my funny answers were greeted with loud silence, except for two or three, which got booed. It was obvious what I had to do. I stayed up all night rewriting the entire act and switched our roles. I became the straight man and Gracie became the comedian. And this time I got the opening right. Here's how it went. When Gracie and I, hand in hand, got to stage center, she glanced back to the side that we just made our entrance from. There, standing just behind the curtain where the audience could see him, was a tall, good-looking man, motioning her to come over to him. She dropped my hand, went to him, and he put his arm around her. They kissed, and he left. Gracie then returned to stage center, where I'd been standing and watching all this. When she got to me, she said, "Who was that?" After waiting for a big laugh to die down, I said, "Gracie, you kiss a man and you don't know who he is?" And she said, "Mother told me never to talk to strangers." Another tremendous laugh. More important, those two lines immediately set Gracie's character for the audience. They also became the pattern for the unique, illogical logic underlining everything she would say from then on. Novelty acts were very popular in vaudeville. There was one act that was really a novelty. This fellow worked with a chicken, and the chicken danced on one leg. The act was called Jackie Davis and Chick Fowler. The fellow's name was Chick Fowler. Chick was a good entertainer, but he liked to drink a lot. Every once in a while, he'd pour a little booze in a saucer for the chicken, and the chicken got to like it. He not only got to like it, he got to love it. Half of the time, he was smashed. Well, it was tough enough for the chicken to dance on one leg when he was sober, but when he was smashed, it was murder. Before you knew it, it got so they couldn't get a job. I ran into Chick one day and said, "Chick, how are things going?" He said, "Not good, George. Things are so tough that last night I pretty near ate my partner." I said, "Chick, you wouldn't do a thing like that." He shook his head and said, "Of course not, but I must admit, I ate the leg he wasn't using." Vaudeville had many great monologists. Of them all, Frank Fay would have to be considered the greatest. That's not just my opinion, it was his too. He was also the most arrogant monologist in vaudeville. You can make that the most arrogant performer in vaudeville. One time he was testifying in court, and when the opposing lawyer asked him what his occupation was, he said, "I'm the greatest comedian in the world." Later, his own lawyer asked him why he would make a statement like that, and he said, "What could I do? I was under oath." Besides being egotistical and arrogant, Frank had another endearing quality. He could be brutally sarcastic, and his sarcasm reflected his arrogance. When he put you down, it was as though he didn't even want to bother with someone so obviously beneath him. Our paths first crossed when Gracie and I played the Palace. He had been the MC there for months, doing the kind of job only Frank Fay could do. While we performed, he stood in the wings watching. After we finished the act, he sauntered over to us and, ignoring me, took Gracie's hand and began to tell her how impressed he was with everything about her. Her unique delivery, her engaging personality, her delicate charm. He couldn't stop complimenting her. And then, still not giving me so much as a glance, he leaned toward her, and she leaned toward him. And he said, "But where did you get the man?" There was only one Frank Fay. One was enough. During the time I was doing the Burns and Allen show on radio, most of the variety shows were using big bands. Our band leader was Artie Shaw. When we moved the show from New York to California, Artie had a problem with James Petrillo, who was then head of the Musicians Union. One of the key men in Artie's band was his trumpet player, and naturally Artie wanted to bring him along to California, but Petrillo wouldn't allow it. Artie was very upset because this trumpet player was extremely important to him, but Petrillo wouldn't give in. The day after we arrived in California, I was on my way to the Brown Derby restaurant to have a drink. And there on the newsstand was a headline that read, "Lana Turner divorces Artie Shaw." There was a picture of Lana in a sweater, and she looked absolutely beautiful. Inside the Derby, there was Artie at the bar, having a drink. I knew how bad he must have felt about losing a beautiful girl like Lana, so I put my arm around him and said, "Artie, don't take it too hard. Things like that happen to everybody." Artie looked at me and said, "To hell with Petrillo. I'll find myself a trumpet player out here." I've always been patient with stutterers. Maybe that's because one of my early vaudeville partners, Billy Lorraine, stuttered so badly that it would take him 5 minutes to say, "Come in." The poor guy could never get out any of the spoken lines in our act, but for some reason he had no problem when he sang. Once when we were playing the Pantages Theater in Los Angeles and living at the Continental Hotel, I went out to get my hair cut. In those days, I had some. When I got back to the hotel, Billy rushed up to me all excited. I could see he had news for me. "Yeah, go on, Billy. He couldn't go on. I said, "Okay, start over." Again, "We got a job?" I took a shot. "We" starts with a W. He shook his head negatively. "So what is it, Billy?" I pleaded. Again, I said, "Sing it, Billy, sing it." And as clear as a bell, he sang, "We were just robbed." For those of you who may not remember him, Joe Penner was a burlesque comic who graduated to radio and at one time had a top-rated radio show. He was the first one to ask, "Wanna buy a duck?" And he asked it so often on his weekly show that it caught on and became a nationwide catchphrase. During one of our summer breaks, I took Gracie and our two kids, Sandy and Ronnie, to Hawaii for a week's vacation, staying at the same hotel with the Penners and two other couples that we knew. Every day we sat around together at the beach, and although Gracie got the laughs when we performed, I was the one who had to keep our little group in stitches. I kept waiting for Penner to come up with something, a story, a topper, a funny line, a dirty joke. Nothing. Not a snicker all week. The last day going up in the elevator in our hotel, this top comedian said to me, "I'm never funny in the summer." This story involves a big comedian who for many years had one of the most popular shows on radio. In person, he was very funny and very fast on the uptake. But because I, like many of us here in Hollywood, know that he was also an incredible womanizer, I won't reveal his name. The tabloids would, but I have higher standards. I'll just tell you that his weekly half-hour show took place in a New York tavern. Anyway, this comedian got married to a very lovely lady, and the newlyweds immediately went on a honeymoon cruise. And right away, the first night out, he wound up in the cabin of another woman. After a few hours, the wife went looking for him, and sure enough, she bumped into him just as he was coming out of the other woman's cabin. And without batting an eye, he said to her, "I forgot to tell you, I'm also a jewel thief." I've always said there are only two comedians who made me laugh when I just looked at them. One was W.C. Fields. This story is about the other one, Ben Blue. Shortly before we came to Hollywood, Gracie and I took a six-act vaudeville unit out on a tour of 8 weeks, and Ben Blue was one of the acts. We got a $10,000 guarantee from each theater, out of which we paid each of the acts, and if the box office receipts were over a specified amount, the theater and Burns and Allen would split the difference. So if business was good, we could make quite a bit of money. We were doing 4 shows a day to capacity crowds, but we would do even better if we could just squeeze in an extra show. However, the only way that could be done was to cut Ben Blue's act from 35 minutes to 13 minutes. And I'll tell you a little secret. It's very difficult to cut an actor, especially Ben Blue, because as much as the audience loved Ben Blue's act, Ben Blue loved it even more. Now, at that time, I was paying Ben Blue $750 a week, so I called him into my dressing room and said, "Sit down, have a drink, here, smoke a cigar. You can't cut my act," he broke in. "Ben," I said, "now that you've brought it up, let me tell you something. You're getting $750 a week, and you're doing 35 minutes. If you cut your act down to 13 minutes, we'll be able to do an extra show, and I'll give you $1,000 a week. You'll be making $250 a week more." He stood up and indignantly said, "Who the hell do you think you're talking to? 13 minutes? That would mean I'd have to take out the 10 cents a dance bit that I do with my wife. And that's the only thing she does in my act. If I cut that, she'd divorce me." I said, "Ben, forget it. I'm sorry I brought it up." With that, he stormed out of the room. I didn't even have time to powder my nose before he stuck his head back into the room and said, $350. "You got it," I said. So we did 5 shows a day. Ben did 13 minutes, and 2 weeks later, his wife divorced him. Isn't that a good story? But wait, there's more. His wife took him to court and sued him for $600 a month alimony. At the trial, Ben defended himself. He said to the judge, "Your Honor, I can't afford to pay my wife $600 a month alimony. If I did that, I wouldn't have enough money to put gas in my Duesenberg." The judge stared at him and said, "You've got a Duesenberg?" There was a pause, and Ben quickly said, "But, Your Honor, don't forget, I drive it myself." The next time I saw Ben Blue, he was driving a Chevrolet. One of the really great funny men in the 20th century was W.C. Fields. He had a funny face and a voice to match, and he kept Broadway and motion picture audiences laughing for decades. He also had a reputation as a drinker, both on and off the screen. He always wore a specially made vest with pockets that held small bottles filled with martinis. I invited him over to have dinner with Gracie and me one night, and when he came into my bar, I had the gin, vermouth, olives, and ice lined up for him. He went to the door, removed his vest, and hollered to his chauffeur, "Clarence, my good man, you may take this vest. I'm getting my libations from another source." In his early drinking days, he went to his doctor for a checkup, and the doctor told him that if he didn't give up drinking, he would have only 6 months to live. 20 years later, still drinking heavily, he went to another doctor at the urging of all his friends. This doctor told him that if he didn't give up drinking, he would have only 6 months to live. "You must be a very good doctor," Fields told him. 20 years ago, another doctor made the same prediction. W.C. Fields and I were good friends until this great comedian passed away. But we didn't actually meet until Gracie and I came out to Hollywood to make our first film for Paramount. It was called International House. And in the movie, Gracie and Fields did a scene in which she played a waitress. She had the last line in the scene and then left, leaving Fields sitting there. Fields wanted to finish the scene with a funny line or a piece of business, but nobody could suggest anything that seemed to work. Then I had an idea. "Look," I suggested, "you've got a cup of coffee, a glass of water, and a martini on the table. As soon as Gracie leaves, why don't you drop 2 cubes of sugar in the water, stir the coffee, and drink the martini?" Fields stared at me for a moment or two, and then he said in that peculiar drawl of his, "This is the first time I've ever liked a straight man." When I made one of my early movies, we had a young actor with us who drove the director crazy. He was a method actor, and he needed a motivation for everything he did. He wouldn't move unless he knew why he was moving. There was this one scene where he had to go to the bathroom. He asked the director why he was going to the bathroom. The director said, "For the same reason everybody goes to the bathroom." The actor said, "We better not do that scene because it won't be believable. I don't have to go to the bathroom." The director stared at him. "Pretend you had breakfast and then go to the bathroom." The actor said, "Should I pretend I had a big breakfast or a small breakfast?" After a long pause, the director said, "What difference would that make?" He said, "I want to know how long to stay in the bathroom." The director said, "Forget the bathroom. You won't be able to get in." He said, "Why not?" The director said, "Because the actor who's taking your place will be in there." That was the end of the method actor. From then on, I didn't take any chances. Whenever the director looked at me, I went to the bathroom. Not many people know that longtime chairman of the board of Paramount Pictures, Adolph Zucker, and I were very close friends. I'm not sure that even Zucker knew it. But Gracie and I did make about 12 pictures for him, and I would often go into his office and play gin rummy with him. We were playing one time, and he knocked and said, "I'm going down with 10. But he had 11. He had a 7 and a 4. I said, "Before we throw the cards in, Mr. Zucker, you know Gracie and I are now doing a picture with Bing Crosby?" And in it, Crosby sings five songs. How about letting me sing one of the songs? He looked right at me and said, George, Bing Crosby, one of our major stars, is going to sing all five songs. So I looked back at him and said, Mr. Zucker, you got 11. He said, George, you and Gracie have been with us now for 6 years. Do you like working for Paramount? I love it. Do you like living out here? I love it. You wouldn't want to go back east. No, sir. Then he said, how much is 7 and 4? I said, 10. Bing Crosby sang the five songs. Gracie and I never moved back east, and I never won a game of gin rummy for Mr. Zucker. One of my very close friends, Eddie Bazell, was one of our top motion picture directors. He directed many movies, including Honolulu, the last motion picture Gracie and I made. Eddie told me a story that I think is worth passing on. When he first came to Hollywood, he went to work for Columbia Pictures. At the end of his first year, he had a verbal agreement with Harry Cohen, who was the president of the company, to get a $250 a week raise. Now, I'm not going to say that Harry Cohen was a hard man to do business with. I don't have to. Everybody else has said it. When the year was up, Eddie went into Cohen's office and asked for his raise. Cohen turned on his charm. He said, Eddie, Sam Briskin is right across the hall. He's head of production, so go in and ask him for the raise. If he says okay, it's certainly all right with me. Cohen stood up and put a fatherly hand on Eddie's shoulder. You know me, Eddie, he continued. When I make somebody the promise, it's a promise. So Eddie went across the hall. When he walked into Briskin's office, Sam wasn't there, but the intercom was buzzing. Eddie pushed down the lever and said, yeah? Cohen's voice came over the intercom. Sam, Bazell is on his way in there to ask for a raise. Don't give it to him. Eddie pushed down the lever just as Sam walked in. Sam said, what can I do for you, Eddie? Trying to act nonchalant, Eddie said, I just left Harry Cohen's office. I'm due for a raise, and he said if it's all right with you, it's all right with him. Well, he's the boss, Sam said. If it's all right with him, you've got it. Eddie Bazell stayed with Columbia Pictures for years and got many raises. But Harry Cohen never knew that Eddie was always $250 ahead of him.
Jack Benny hasn't put his hand in his pocket. January will be 80 years.
What can be keeping him? Doesn't he know what time it is?
No. He's too tight to buy a watch. Tells time by the sun.
Oh, George, tells time by the sun.
I'm not kidding. Shh, here he comes. Oh, hello, George. Hello, Gracie.
Oh, hello, hi, Jack. Jack.
Hey, I'm sorry I'm late, kids. These cloudy days throw me.
Well, last week, Gracie's mother arrived at the Burns house for an extended visit, and she's made it very clear that she doesn't approve of her son-in-law being in show business. She keeps telling Gracie that she should have married a bricklayer, or a carpenter, or a mechanic.
Or a painter, or a plumber, or an electrician. Someone who'd be useful if anything goes wrong around the house.
Oh, George is pretty handy, Mama. When our radio was broken, George got it fixed with one finger.
One finger.
He went to the phone and dialed the repairman.
There you are. Your husband is a puny, helpless little nincompoop. Why, I'll bet if the lights suddenly went out, he wouldn't do a blessed thing.
Well, Mama, we've been married for 15 years.
I mean he wouldn't know how to fix them. Oh, Gracie, darling, I'd like to go back to San Francisco. But you need someone around here to look after you.
Oh, but Mama, George is a wonderful husband. Even if he isn't show business, he's a good provider.
I don't believe it. How can he earn a living on the radio?
Oh, he makes people laugh.
But on the radio, who can see his face?
They don't have to see him, Mama. He's a fine comedian. But George is...
Hello.
Oh, hello, dear.
Well, where have you been? Have you been out shooting pool and gambling?
I was
Of course you have. Where else would you be? How much did you lose? Everything you had, of course.
I was down...
And now you're home to borrow money from me. You're getting the money from me. You're not getting it from me unless you steal it. Would you stoop to that?
I wouldn't.
Oh, you would you, huh? Gracie, are you going to stand by and see your husband steal my money?
I have no
idea. George, give Mama back her money.
Of all the movies I've made, the only one that had me worried was the one that turned out to be my biggest hit with the critics as well as with the public. I'm talking about the first Oh God film. When I heard that Warner Brothers wanted me to play God in the movie, I was very excited. They had a great script by Larry Gilbart. Carl Reiner would direct it, and John Denver would be starring in it with me. It sounded great. But the minute I accepted the role, I started to worry. Should I be the one to play God? We're both about the same age, but we grew up in different neighborhoods. Maybe they'd be better off with someone like Billy Graham. He's taller than I am. If I played him, what would be my attitude? My motivation? What kind of voice should I use? I was very confused, so I looked up and I hollered, "How do you play God?" But there was no answer. Then when they showed me the outfits I'd be wearing for the role, I figured they didn't have any more confidence in me than I did. I was expecting white flowing robes and a halo or two. That stuff they were going to put me in must have cost about 12 cents. It looked like God was laid off. The closer we got to the starting date, the more nervous I got. I lay awake at night, tossing and turning. I should never have accepted the role. I'll be a flop. The critics will pan my every move. Then one night this thought occurred to me. What am I worrying about? I can't be criticized. Nobody has ever seen him, so they don't know whether I played him right or wrong, whether I was good or bad. That changed my whole attitude. Now I couldn't wait to get started. In the week that still remained before shooting began, I lived the part, rehearsing day and night, before dinner, after dinner, during dinner, while driving, while doing my exercises. I never stopped. I got so into the role that one night, when I said my prayers, I realized I was talking to myself. The day we finally started shooting the movie, any lingering doubts that I had disappeared. Everything felt right. John Denver was perfectly cast and a pleasure to work with. So was Carl Reiner, although every once in a while he'd take me aside and say, "Look, George, this scene isn't moving. It needs a little more God stuff." Or, "George, we're going to do that scene over. It needs more Godishness." Once he stopped the scene right in the middle to say, "Hold it, George. You read that speech all wrong. God would never say it that way." "Look, Carl," I said, "the last time you had lunch with him, did he have any other suggestions?" Carl paused for a second, then started to laugh. "Okay, George, do it your way." Carl Reiner and I had a very delightful relationship. One day just before lunch, he came up to me a little worried and said, "George, I'm in trouble. I'm supposed to speak at a luncheon today at the Sportsman's Lodge, and I forgot my toupee. Can I borrow yours?" "Of course, Carl. What are friends for?" So he put on my toupee and left. When he returned, I asked him, "How did your speech go, Carl?" "Your hair was a riot," he said. In one of my films, they had a young bit player who was very pretty, but a terrible actress. However, she was very ambitious and decided that if she got some experience in the theater, it would help her career. Fortunately, she had a wealthy boyfriend who backed a road company of The Diary of Anne Frank, just so she could play the leading role, Anne Frank. Before the opening in Cleveland, Ohio, they had 3 weeks of intensive rehearsals, and every day was more and more frustrating for the director. The actress was impossible. She couldn't remember her lines, her delivery was amateurish, and the more she rehearsed, the worse she got. The director was ready to quit the show, but she told him she was a poor rehearser. "Believe me," she said, "when I face that opening night audience, it'll all come together." She invited me to the opening night, but I was not all that anxious to see her perform, and I had even less desire to be in Cleveland in February. A friend of hers and mine did go, and later he told me what I'd missed. When the curtain went up, she blew her opening lines, and her performance went downhill from then on. By the intermission, the audience was totally fed up with her. Then in the first scene in the second act, when the Nazi soldiers broke into the home, overturning furniture and shouting, "Where is she? Where is Anne Frank?" the whole audience yelled back, "She's in the attic!" I love Anne Margaret, not only because she's one of the nicest girls in show business, but because she always tells everyone that I discovered her. When she was 19 years old, I took her to Las Vegas to appear in my act during the holidays. On opening night, she came off the stage and started to cry. I said, "Annie, why are you crying? The audience loved you." She said it was Christmas Eve and she missed her mother. So I told her to go into my dressing room and phone her mother and charge it to me. Then I went out on stage to entertain. An hour later, I went back to my dressing room and she was still on the phone. I sat there and waited until she was finished. Then I said, "Annie, you're not crying anymore. Your mother was glad to hear from you, right?" She said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Burns, we had a wonderful conversation." I asked her why she didn't invite her mother to Las Vegas, and she told me she couldn't. Her mother lived in Sweden. Then I started to cry. After Sammy Davis lost sight in one eye when he was in that car accident many years ago, he was afraid to drive. Several years later, Joey Bishop, Sammy, and I were set to do a big benefit show in Las Vegas, and Sammy, who had overcome his fear by then, insisted that we let him drive us there in his car. We weren't on the freeway 20 minutes before I realized the kid not only lived fast, he drove fast. The motorcycle policeman behind us must have realized that too, because a minute later, he pulled us over to the side of the road.
"I was only going 65,
Sammy said before the cop could open his mouth. "Sorry, buddy, you were doing 80, the cop corrected him. "Why don't you keep your eye on this speedometer?" Joey Bishop broke in. "Officer, the man has only one eye. Do you want him to watch the road or the speedometer?" I was a little annoyed with Joey. He shouldn't have said that line about Sammy's eye. I should have said it. Ever since becoming a member of the Hillcrest Country Club, I've always sat at the same table when I have my lunch. It's called the round table. The reason it's called the round table is because it's a table that's round. I feel that an author should throw in these bits of information now and then. On second thought, maybe this is one I should have thrown out. Anyway, for many, many years, when you sat at the round table, you would be surrounded by the biggest comedians in the business. There were the Marx Brothers, Groucho, Chico, and Harpo. The Ritz Brothers, Harry, Jimmy, and Al. Jack Benny, George Jessel, Danny Kaye, Al Jolson, Eddie Cantor, Lou Holtz, and sometimes a few more, each one trying to top the others. They're all gone, and I sit alone at the round table. Now I'm the funniest one there. In the old days, Jessel was the funniest, to me at least. Even though Jack Benny was my closest friend, I can't say he was the funniest. He was the best audience, the one who made all the rest think that they were funniest. With or without Jack Benny, Groucho thought he was the funniest. Sometimes maybe he was. Groucho had a very fast, caustic wit. He was loaded with great puns, and even more, loaded with gall. If the right situation came up, he didn't mind repeating the same joke 20 times in one day. Years ago, Sophie Tucker used to sing a song called "If You Can't See Mama Every Night, You Can't See Mama at All." Well, Groucho did a big job at the round table with that one. Every time I ordered sea bass, without fail, Groucho would say, "If you can't see bass every night, you can't see bass at all." I laughed the first time he said it, but after hearing it for 40 years, it begins to lose its freshness. One day I wanted to order sea bass for lunch, but Groucho was sitting at the table, and I didn't want to hear that lousy joke again. So I took the waiter aside and I quietly whispered, "I'll have some sea bass." And the waiter quietly whispered back, "If you can't see bass every night, you can't see bass at all." After hearing that line again from the waiter, I decided it was time to change my diet. I went back to the table and said, "Groucho, do you have any jokes about whitefish?" He said, "No, George." I turned to the waiter and said, "I'll have some whitefish." And Groucho said, "If you can't see whitefish every night, you can't see whitefish at all." I told you he had gall. Do you remember Luke Clayton of Clayton, Jackson, and Durante? He started out as a dancer in their original act and later became the business manager. Durante and Jackson were both pussycats, but Lou, who was only about 5'6", had a hot temper, was tough as nails, and didn't take anything from anybody. Well, one day we played golf together. He had a good first nine, but on the second nine he shanked a 2-iron into the lake. It upset him so much that he picked up his big bag with all those beautiful clubs and threw them into the lake too. I couldn't believe it. I said to him, "Lou, why do you play golf?" And he said, "It relaxes me." It's hard to believe, but there was a period in Al Jolson's life when his career was at a standstill. Suddenly, the world's greatest entertainer was old hat and the jobs weren't coming in. At that time, sturgeon wasn't sold in California. Al Jolson, who still had millions, was very fond of this delicacy. So every week, he'd fly in $150 worth of sturgeon and keep it in the refrigerator at our country club. I often had lunch with him, and one day I said to him, "Jolie, to me you'll always be the greatest showman that ever lived." Beaming over my big compliment, he said, "Thanks, George. And how would you like a little sturgeon for lunch?" I said I'd love it, and it was delicious. After that, every time I saw Jolson, I paid him a compliment, and I had sturgeon for lunch. It got so I liked sturgeon more than I liked Jolson. Then Columbia made the Jolson story, an instant smash. Larry Parks played Jolson, but he didn't do the singing. It was Jolson who sang every song on the soundtrack, which became the hit of the movie. I saw the film and was thrilled. The next day, when I saw Jolson, I said, "Jolie, I saw the movie, and that soundtrack is the greatest thing I've ever heard." Looking straight at me, he said, "You can buy your own sturgeon, kid. I'm a hit again." Of all the comedians I've known, George Jessel may not have been the most successful, but without a script, he was the funniest. I'm not sure about this, but I think he also said, "I do," the most often. In all fairness, if his five weddings set a record, you'd have to put an asterisk after it, because three of those weddings were to the same woman, his first wife, Florence Courtney. When he met her, Florence was one of the Courtney sisters, a popular singing act on the same vaudeville circuit he was playing. In 1921, 2 years after their wedding, he divorced her. She must have had something going for her, because he had to remarry and divorce her twice more before he got her out of his system. Georgie's next wife was the beautiful screen star Norma Talmadge. And finally, when he was in his 40s, came wife number three, the 16-year-old starlet Lois Andrews, who taught him how to play hopscotch. The marriage to Norma Talmadge lasted the longest. He was crazy about her, but they quarreled constantly. Finally, one day she left him for a doctor in Miami, Florida. Jessel went out of his mind. He bought a gun, chartered a plane, flew to Miami, and went straight to her hotel. When she opened the door to her suite, there, beside her, was the doctor. Jessel pulled out his gun and took a shot at him. But instead of hitting the doctor, the bullet went through the window and wound up 2 blocks away in the rear end of a gardener who was bent over cultivating pansies. When the gardener took Jessel to court, the judge asked, "Mr. Jessel, how is it possible for you to take a shot at someone 10 feet from you and hit a gardener 2 blocks away?" "Your Honor," Jessel answered, "I'm an actor, not Buffalo Bill." Here's another Sammy Davis story. When Sammy was an up-and-coming young performer, having gone out on his own from the Will Mastin Trio, Jerry Lewis, Jack Benny, and several other top entertainers helped him prepare a solo act. They gave him advice, plugged him into all the networks and studios, and heckled his agent to get him better jobs. Sammy was so grateful that he converted to Judaism. As soon as Sammy became a star, he began spending fortunes on jewelry and clothes and started a series of golf lessons. He bought the most expensive set of golf clubs and 10 cashmere golf outfits. When I heard that Sammy was interested in golf, I invited him to the Hillcrest Country Club to play a round with me. While we were waiting to tee off on the first hole, I asked him what kind of a handicap he had.
"The biggest," Sammy replied. "I'm a black, one-eyed Jew."
All in all, I've been pretty lucky with my health. In fact, after having my tonsils out when I was still in vaudeville, I didn't see another doctor for 20 years. Oddly enough, it was for my throat again. I had developed sort of a tickle in my throat, which caused me to constantly keep clearing it. I got so I couldn't even finish a sentence without doing it. By then, I was married to Gracie, and with all this hacking of mine, she couldn't get any sleep. Also, we were on the radio at the time, so I was not only annoying Gracie, I was annoying the whole country. Anyway, I went to all the great doctors, every throat specialist I could find. They all looked into my throat and said the same thing: stop smoking. So I stopped, and it got worse. One day, Abe Lasvogel, he was the head of William Morris Agency, called me and said, "George, I heard you on the radio last night, and you better do something about that throat. If you keep hacking that way, the sponsor's never going to renew your contract." I said, "Abe, I don't know what to do. I've been to every doctor in the country." "George," Abe said, "you haven't been to Dr. Ginsburg. He runs a little eye, ear, nose, and throat clinic in downtown Los Angeles. He only charges $3 a visit, and he's a genius." Well, I got down there as fast as I could. When I went into his office, there were about 40 people in the waiting room. I went over to the nurse and said, "Would you tell Dr. Ginsburg that George Burns is sitting outside?" She went into the other office, and a minute later she returned. She said, "I told Dr. Ginsburg that George Burns was sitting outside, and he told me to tell you that Dr. Ginsburg is sitting inside." So I sat down, hacked, coughed, cleared my throat, and waited my turn. When I finally got into the doctor's office, I kept hacking and hacking and hacking. He examined my throat and said, "What's your problem?" I said, "What's my problem? Can't you tell? I keep making this hacking noise." The doctor said, "Why do you do that?" I sat there stunned. Nobody had ever asked me that question before. I said, "I don't know why I do it." Dr. Ginsburg said, "Then if I were you, I wouldn't do it anymore." And you know something? I never did. Goldie Hawn is a beautiful girl and a great actress, and I always enjoyed working with her. She guest starred in one of my television specials, and her dressing room was right next to mine. There was a hole in the wall between our two rooms. I didn't cover it up. I figured, let the kid enjoy herself. This one is about Judy Garland. I had been asked to speak at one of those big Hollywood testimonial dinners where all those who are going to be on the dais wait together in a reception room until all the guests have been seated at their tables. This night I was in the reception room, sitting with Judy Garland, and Sid Luft, whom Judy was married to at the time, took me aside and said, "George, you'll be sitting next to Judy on the dais too, and you can do me a very, very big favor. Don't let her drink too much tonight because she has to sing." I assured Sid that I'd take care of it. When I went back to Judy, there on the table were two dry martinis. I quickly drank half of mine, and when she wasn't looking, I switched glasses. I did that in the reception room, and I did that when we were seated at the dais. I must have done it 5 or 6 times, maybe 10. I was so busy switching glasses, I didn't have time to count. About 20 olives later, George Jessel, who was master of ceremonies, introduced me saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, and now George Burns." I looked around and couldn't find him. Milton Berle, who was also on the dais, came over and picked me up. "That's you. You're George Burns," he said. I just stood there, starting to make my speech without even going to the microphone. Naturally, nobody heard me, which is just as well, since I wasn't making any sense. Milton quickly pushed me back into my seat, and Jessel explained to the audience, "George Burns' speech was written by that famous writing team of Haig and Haig." Later, Judy got up and sang "Over the Rainbow," and was a smash. She was over the rainbow, and I was under the table. On the way out, after the dinner was over, Sid Luft said to me, "George, you were disgusting tonight." Of all my appearances in England, the most exciting might have been in 1976, when I performed at the London Palladium, a Royal Gala charity concert attended by Her Royal Highness Princess Margaret. It was a very successful evening and raised a lot of money. Following the concert, the producer ushered me up to the royal box to meet Princess Margaret. There were a number of people there, and seated in the center of the group was this charming lady. So I went up to her and I said, "Your Highness, it's a pleasure for me to meet you." I'd curtsy, but if I got down, I wouldn't be able to get up again. She laughed and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Burns, I'm not Princess Margaret. I'm the lady in waiting." Just then the princess came in. I turned to her and I said, "Your Highness, it's a pleasure for me to meet you, and you just missed one of my big jokes." The princess gave me a puzzled look, and as she sat down, she gestured for me to sit next to her. We had a very pleasant conversation, and then she said, "Mr. Burns, you sing so fast I practically missed the lyrics to your first song." I said, "Your Highness, would you like to hear me sing it again?" She said, "No, once is enough. I had a funny comeback, but I'm not topping a princess." Well, a few minutes later, the princess stood up, and I assumed that this was my cue to leave. As I said goodbye and started to go, she stopped me and whispered, "No, no, Mr. Burns, I'm supposed to leave first." I quickly stepped aside, and she left. Then as I started to leave again, the lady-in-waiting tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Mr. Burns, I'm supposed to leave next." After she left, I sat down. I didn't want to start another war with England. I sat there until everybody had left. Finally, an usher opened up the curtains to the box and said, "Mr. Burns, the theater is empty, and you can leave after I do." Like many performers, I'm constantly being interviewed, and you'd be amazed at how many times I have to answer the same kinds of questions. A few years ago, I got a phone call from a newspaper woman. She said, "Mr. Burns, is it true that you go out with young girls?" I said, "It's true." She said, "Is it true that you smoke 10 or 15 cigars a day?" I said, "It's true." She said, "What does your doctor say?" I said, "He's dead." I keep hearing from my young colleagues like Milton Berle, Henny Youngman, and Sid Caesar that these days it's a different kind of show business. Everything now is sex and nudity. They're not complaining, mind you. They're just stating facts. When I was young, things were different. I remember playing the Chicago World's Fair in the 1930s. I was on the same bill with Sally Rand. She did her famous fan dance, and it was supposed to be very, very naughty. But it was nothing. She came out on stage wearing flesh-colored leotards, and the lights on the stage were dark blue. You could hardly see her. And when she did her fan dance, her fans were so big, they covered her completely. That was it. She got sick one night, so I took her place and nobody knew the difference. I think most performers appreciate it when total strangers take the time to say a complimentary word or two. I know I do. But once in a while, they'll come up with something that leaves you more annoyed than grateful. Even though it had to be more than 60 years ago, I still remember this one. Gracie and I had been on the radio for just a couple of weeks, and we were walking down Broadway when a man stopped us. "Aren't you Burns and Allen?" he asked. We said we were, and he continued, "I heard you last night all the way from Cleveland." And he walked away. Gracie and I exchanged looks, and just then the man came back and added, "I can also get Philadelphia on my radio." I said, "Thank you. That's quite a compliment." Once when Gracie and I were spending an evening with Yasha Heifetz, one of the world's greatest violinists, he told us of an experience he had in Akron, Ohio. He was giving a concert there, but that night there was a terrible storm, and only about 12 people showed up. So the manager walked out and said he was very sorry, but Mr. Heifetz wouldn't appear that night, and they would be refunding everybody's money. Well, this one fellow went backstage and said, "Mr. Heifetz, I'm one of your biggest fans. My wife and I drove all the way from Youngstown to see you. Couldn't you at least sing one song for us?" Several years ago, I came up with an idea for a publicity stunt that I thought was tremendous. I was sure it would break into newspapers all over the country. Everybody always kids me about my singing, so I decided to take advantage of it and insure my voice for $1 million. A brilliant idea, wasn't it? I was so excited I couldn't wait to rush down to the insurance company, and I took a cassette and a tape recorder with me so that the insurance man could hear my voice. I explained to him that I wanted to insure my voice for $1 million, and I played my cassette for him. It was one of my best numbers, a syncopated version of Yankee Doodle Blues, with a yodeling finish. He sat there and listened patiently to the whole thing, then he just looked at me and said, "Mr. Burns, you should have come to us before you had the accident." This kid made me kind of nervous. That was a very funny line, and I couldn't think of a way to top it. But it didn't dull my enthusiasm any. I kept right on punching. I said, "Look, this is my natural way of singing, and you don't have to worry about having to pay any claims. Whatever is going to happen to my voice has already happened." He sighed and said, "Mr. Burns, we're talking about a $1 million policy. I could understand if you sang like Crosby, Sinatra, or Tony Bennett. They have trained voices." I said, "Okay, so mine isn't even housebroken. But let me tell you the truth. This whole idea is a publicity stunt. I take out this big policy, it breaks in all the papers, I pay the first premium, and then we cancel." He shook his head and said, "Mr. Burns, you're wasting your time. If my boss heard that cassette with that yodeling finish, there's no way in the world he'd approve the policy." "I'll make a deal with you," I said. "If your boss doesn't okay the policy, I'll buy you a new suit of clothes." He shrugged and took the cassette into the next office. 5 minutes later, he came out and said, "Mr. Burns, make that a blue suit with double vents in the jacket and dark blue piping on the lapels." Well, I never got the policy, but to show you what a sweet man I am, I threw in a monogram handkerchief for his breast pocket. I had 7 sisters and 4 brothers, but the one I usually talked about in my stage show and TV specials was my sister Goldie. Not the real, lovable, conservative Goldie, but a Goldie that we created to get laughs. Our Goldie was not what I would call a loose woman. She was what I would call a very loose woman. For example, at a point in my stage act, I would say to the audience, "Here's a couple of songs written by a piano player who worked in a house of ill repute. And the only ones who knew the songs were the girls who worked there, ladies of the evening. My sister Goldie taught me the songs." A little later I would say, "There's one thing I'd like to clear up. My sister Goldie did not work in a house of ill repute. She owned it." That was typical of the way we portrayed Goldie, and as long as the laughs continued, we stayed with it. One day I got a call from my sister Mamie. When she said she wanted to talk to me about Goldie, I thought, here comes the lecture. I said, "What about Goldie?" She said, "You're always doing those off-color stories about Goldie, and I don't think it's right." "Mamie," I said, "I just do that to get laughs. Why is that so wrong?" "Because I'm your sister too," Mamie said. "Why can't you do those stories about me for a change?" Everyone has little quirks that are hard to account for. That is, everyone but me. I don't have any quirks, big or little. I'm positive of that. Some people would say that in itself is a quirk. Milton Berle had a manager named Danny Welks, who told me a quirk about Milton's that he could never understand. Milton would say to him, "Danny, there's something important we have to discuss. Call me tonight at 9:42. Danny would call him at exactly 9:42. The next night it would go like this. "Danny, something's come up. Call me at 10:18 tonight." Danny would call at 10:18. When they were through, it would be, "Danny, we have to talk further on this. Get back to me at 11:02. It went on like this for months. Never, "Get back to me at your convenience, or as soon as you can, or tomorrow, or this evening, or around midnight." It was always to the minute. And that was exactly when Danny called. One night, Milton told Danny to call him at 10:46 the next morning. In order to do that, Danny had to break a dentist's appointment. But when the time came, he didn't get around to calling Milton's number until 10:49. He heard the phone picked up at the other end, and then Milton's voice saying, "Hello, stranger." Someone once said, you know you're old when you bend over to tie your shoelaces and you say to yourself, what else can I do while I'm down here? Another indication that you're old is when you have to quote someone else's funny line to start a story. I just did that, but I didn't have to. I could have started by stating that you've reached old age when each of your birthdays starts getting more and more attention. For me, that began with my 80th birthday. The cards and presents took a big jump on that one. One of the nicest presents I got came from Danny and Rosie Thomas. It was a beautiful silk Japanese kimono with a dragon all over the back. I sent them a note, which Danny told me they promptly framed and kept on a table in their living room. This is what the note said. Dear Danny and Rosie, thanks so much for that beautiful kimono. It looked so good on me that when a girlfriend came over the next night, I couldn't wait to model it for her. I told her I'd be right down, quickly put on the kimono, and stopped halfway down the stairs to pose for her. She said, wow! Then I opened the kimono, and she put on her hat and coat and went home. Abe Lasvogel ran the William Morris Agency forever, but he was just a little man, about 5 feet 2 inches. He wanted people to look up to him, so whenever it was possible, he would hire young agents his height or less. If his career ever bottomed out, Mickey Rooney knew he would always have a place to go. I was a client of the agency for many years, and when I visited their offices, I felt like a giant. At one of the William Morris Christmas parties, they invited all their motion picture, stage, and television stars, and we all mingled with the little agents and their wives. In the middle of the party, one of the agents rushed over to Abe Lasvogel's table with his young son in tow. Abe, he said, this is my son. When he graduates from high school, I'd like him to get a job at the agency. He's only 14, and look how short he is already.
This is Milton Berle again, and I want to say thanks, George. You've left a wonderful legacy. You may have been short in stature, but you'll always be a giant to me. So, right now I'm going to light up a cigar in your memory and say, good night, Georgie.
I wanted to like you. She doesn't think that you can earn a living as a comedian. We'll prove it to her that you can. Make her laugh. Tell her a joke.
Tell her a joke?
Yes. Tell her the joke about the baker who worked night and day because he needed dough.
Tell it? You just...
Go on, show her how you make a living.
But, Gracie, you just...
You heard what she said. Tell me the joke about the baker who worked all day and night because he needed dough.
A baker worked day and night because he needed dough.
He must have a sideline.
You didn't tell it very well, George. I even had the feeling that I'd heard it before.
It's hard to work without makeup.
But that's not as good.